Just jumping in here quickly to let you guys know that I have recently created a Facebook group for listeners of the Live, Train, Perform podcast. So this private forum is the place to connect with other podcast listeners and guests, as well as to interact with myself and other coaches who have provided content for the Coach's Corner episodes. So in this forum, you can ask questions, which I can then answer in the group, or I can use them for episodes for my Q&A sessions, post relevant articles, you can share memes. The goal is to create a network of like-minded people so that everyone can interact with each other. You guys, the listeners, the audience members can interact with a network of professionals in the fitness industry that have provided good quality content for the podcast. To gain access to this private group, all you need to do is leave me a rating and review. What this does is allows me to bump up the ratings, draw bigger names, bigger guests to the podcast for your listening pleasure. Once you've left a rating and review, take a screenshot of that, send that through to my Instagram at coach_Kobes, K-O-B-E-S. Once you've done that, go onto Facebook, type in Live, Train, Perform. That group will come up, request access, answer the three questions, and I will grant you access. I am in the process of building out my online business. One of the income streams is going to be from the Facebook forum. So I'm going to be allowing 50 people into that forum for free. After that, it will be paid access only. So get in early, be one of the OGs. Thanks, guys. Much appreciated. Hey guys, welcome to the Live, Train, Perform podcast. I'm your host, Sean Kober, and joining me today is Joel Smith. Joel's been in the strength and conditioning game for 15 years. He is an author and also a podcast host. Joel, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast, mate. I've been listening to the Just Fly Performance podcast for a number of years now, and I've taken a lot of value from it. So first of all, thank you for putting the content out. And secondly, thank you for coming on my podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sean. It's great to be here. And these ones on the other side of the globe are always fun. It's morning for me, night for you. So I'm excited for this.
Now, how does it feel being on the other side of the microphone? Because you're normally the one that's interviewing other people and asking the questions. How do you feel being on the other side of the mic?
I think it's very relaxing, to be honest. I think that my mind, it works in interesting ways. And I usually am not a very like hyper-focused individual. I think I'm a little bit ADHD and I like to do a lot of things at once. But when I sit down and podcast, I actually can focus, but it is very draining because it's like I have all these mental balls in the air and I'm trying to figure out what questions to come back to. And It's just nice not to have to worry about that. So I really do enjoy, and my wife says I like to talk. So it's, which I try to be more mindful of what I say each one of these I do. these are great. I really like being on the other side.
Awesome, man. I appreciate it. For my listeners that don't know who you are, can you give them a brief introduction to who you are? Keep it fairly short. I'll dive into anything that comes up and we'll go into a little bit more detail and kind of pick up the ball from wherever you leave it.
Yeah, sounds good. So the short version, and I practice the short version with each one of these. I think the first podcast I was on, someone asked, it might have been like 10 minutes. So long and short of it would be I grew up playing all sorts of sports. Eventually, basketball was a big one, soccer. Eventually settled on track and field, though. Track and field became my coaching route in the sense that that's what I did as a sport in college, high jump, triple jump, eventually through the javelin, and really, really loved that. Did a little sprinting, wasn't quite as fast as I was, I guess, athletic in the jumping and throwing elements. But I eventually, in college, I was like, oh, well, I want to do something with athletes. And well, strength and conditioning is a job, so I'm going to do that. But I get to grad school for applied sports sciences or performance, and they're kind of like, well, you have to pick. You have to be a strength coach or a track coach. You can't really do both, which is not true, by the way. But they wanted me to kind of make my decision to be one or the other. So I chose track, and I coached track in the college ranks here for 6 years. And then it was time for a transition. So it wasn't my choice, but I was then reached out to at the end of my time coaching track by a Division I or bigger university here to do strength and conditioning. To be honest, I wasn't that excited about it in the sense that I was going to be doing just the strength training for track. So imagine you were a basketball coach, and you know, and then all of a sudden the only way to go up is to be a strength coach for basketball. Like you it's a smaller piece of the pie. And so in many ways, initially, at least, I was like, well, it's a better job. It's a bigger school. It's in California. And that actually journey of just strength and conditioning or human performance really took me on an important leg in my coaching journey that I wouldn't have got otherwise. There was a lot of, like, I think just mental and emotional and psychological ways that I was approaching coaching that weren't healthy, that getting to more of the core of it all in strength and conditioning, if you want to call it that, was really important for me personally. I also in that time had the opportunity to work with a lot more sports than I would have worked with in detail, just obviously being a track coach. And I did do strength and conditioning as a track coach. I was the strength coach for like the basketball team and did a lot of, I was involved, but not heavily. And then as I went through my time at Cal, I got involved, or at Cal, or UC Berkeley was a school, I got involved in swimming. I did strength and conditioning for swimming for 7 years. And that was really transformative to me because, and all these things are just human performance. Like track is human performance. Lifting weights or whatever you're doing to improve, they say the athlete is human performance. Swimming is human performance. These are all different perspectives on this same thing. And so swimming is like this totally different world. It's in the water. It's three-dimensional. It's a different sensory pattern. It's just, but it was just so amazing to be able to, and the swim programs were good at Cal. I mean, they were extremely good, like top three in the nation level, or they won the national championship a few times when I was there, tons of Olympians and elite performers. And so not only that, just the great coaches and seeing how they would approach coaching and a different way of just approaching training the human body, but you also get to see the mind and the mindset of all these elite performers and what distinguishes them just from, I guess, people who might not. And obviously they're gifted physically, but there was other things I felt like that were really interesting to watch with these elite level athletes. And then after 7 years of swimming, if you look at your life in series of sevens, I moved on from Cal. I just felt like my learning curve there was starting to drop a little bit in terms of just what I was able to learn each year. And it was also just really expensive living in the area, and I wanted to get on to do other things. So I've had the Just Fly Sports kind of world for about 10 years now, the podcast. I train athletes online, and so I had an opportunity to go live somewhere more affordable and settle down closer to home, closer to family. So here I am in Ohio. I train athletes in the Cincinnati area and online, and run the Just Fly Performance podcast. And it's it's been a really fun journey so far, and here I am. So I probably took a little longer than I meant to, but that encapsulates as much as the important details as I think I can state there.
No, that was pretty solid, man. And there's a couple of things that I want to kind of unpack there, because I think it's important for the listeners to hear as well, and also for myself, just for my own interests. So you said, just correct me if this is incorrect, you said you went from a track coach to a strength coach for track. Was that correct?
Yes.
Talk to me about that process, because, you know, there's things that you would have learned as a track coach that you may not have learned as a strength and conditioning coach, but because you had experience as a track coach with, you know, biomechanics of running, etc., you can then take that and apply that as a strength coach. Did you feel that that gave you an advantage as a strength coach for track athletes?
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing, there's like the biomechanics and nuance, like you could call it knowing what special strength exercises to do. And track is one of the most easy and straightforward sports to do that in, because I mean, it's like, compared to training like basketball, how many movements could you do in basketball versus track? There's so many more, there's so much more potential movement. So or football or soccer, whatever, there's a lot more, the specificity, I think, doesn't go as far the more open the sport is. So a more closed sport where it's a more singular skill with track, you can feel like you're doing things in the weight room, I think, that pack more punch in terms of transfer. So there is that. But if anything, I think what I learned, and then also watching like the swim strength coach at Cal, who was there before, or working with swimmers before me, he was a high-level swimmer himself. And there is something where you can find relational points between yourself and the athletes you're working with. And if I was a track coach or a track athlete, the language you use and them knowing that you understand them, I think is really important. And with swimming, eventually I was able to do that just by, I think, enough time in the field and enough time, and you gain the respect, and they're like, okay, yes, like I feel like you understand where I'm coming from. But an athlete having belief and buy-in, which I think is talked about a lot, but also feeling like they are understood from, hey, this coach knows what it's like to be me and do my sport. I think that's one of the bigger ones, especially too when we're talking about, like Dan John said this when he was on my podcast, is like, he said, how do we know exactly how weights transfer to throwing, I think was his example. How do we know how lifting weights helps you throw farther? You could say a bunch of things on motor recruitment or bigger muscles or whatever, but I don't think we know exactly in some perspectives. And the further we get away from throwing too, like sprinting or any other sport we play, how do you say how much you did as the strength coach from a transfer perspective? It could be 10%. It could be 0% for some people, honestly, from like just a pure mechanical transfer perspective. And that's where it's just a little bit of a complex and interesting situation. But I think there's a lot of mental and emotional nuance in there. That's really important, almost like archetypes, if you will. That connection of basic human level training, hopefully it transfers, maybe some of it doesn't, but we're still doing something important here. And there's a connection is an important factor.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about that you moved from one sport to another sport, to another sport, to another sport? How did you work your way across a multitude of sports with multiple athletes?
Oh yeah. So yeah, when I started at Cal, I was there for track primarily. And it was funny because track in here in America, in the college system, track is like the last sport it's like the beginner sport for all the, if you're the strength coach and it's your first sport, like that's like the newbie or the bottom of the chain.
Right.
Because most track coaches have their own lifting program and you're kind of the babysitter. And so from my experience, I wrote most of the programs, not all of them. And actually it was a really good learning experience for the programs I had to just monitor. That was really good for me because there was some stuff I immediately would have disagreed with. But then you actually watch it happen and you're like, oh, you know what? That actually worked. And so now I have to change my paradigm a little bit in the sense of what can work. And I think we really get caught into like, oh, that won't work, or you know, you need
just
to deal with
it. That's a great point. Do you think that ties into everything you just said before about the athlete buy-in and the coaches understanding the athletes? You know, you might have known, you know, from your theory, from your courses or your degree or whatever, that, hey, maybe this is not the most optimal way of doing this. However, that coach knows his athletes and knows that that's probably the best way to get them to organize themselves in a manner that's going to allow them to achieve the goal.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, these coaches have spent time and they've gone through this and they've gone through trial and error. And I saw that in swimming immensely, because swimming, it's almost like in track, and track and strength and conditioning have a lot of shared, like if you read the books or whatever, that here's a track program and here's a strength conditioning program, you're probably gonna see a lot of similarities. You'll see maybe 3 weeks of loading, 1 week of unloading, and there are those kinds of things that share space. But swimming, I don't think those rules are played by a whole lot. It's more like, in some level, it's overtrain a lot and then taper hard at the end, and some version of that. But there's a reason that that exists in swimming, and I'm not exactly sure why. But the coach is still, I mean, I feel like relative to those athletes' total highest capabilities, they were reached like in no different of a manner than another sport. And so you learn that experience and intuition is the greatest teacher there. I mean, obviously you need to be able to back what you do on, you know, in terms of reproducibility, and you could use data to help prove your point. But at the end of the day, a throws coach told this to me at Cal. He's like, if it works, it works. And I think that we can undermine the complexity of the body in the sense of its ability to adapt to things we wouldn't normally think. That's I think, you know, you could talk about putting yourself in a mental box, like early belief systems, like if a child has early belief systems, and then at the rest of their life, they're going to be pegging everything based off those things. And if anything, I've learned being in swimming and some of these other training is like, you know what, some of this training that I thought wouldn't work, it does. And then there might be a million reasons for that. So I'm almost getting. With the throws coach, with that whole system. That was a really important part of my learning process. It expanded my mind, and I think people need to. It's insane. I don't spend a lot of time on social media, but I just do find it interesting. It seems like most of the interactions that people have on like Twitter or something are either just self like glorifying. I'll like the things I agree with. I'll, you know, write a negative comment on the things I don't like. There's people aren't there to learn anything. And that was one of the, for the most part, I don't think some people probably are, but it's, you learn by, in many, so many ways in this field by being exposed to a system that you thought wasn't going to work or that is different than what you thought. And you have to sit in it, and you have to, and that's the one of the beautiful things of the strength coach position is you had to sit in it. I could disagree, but it doesn't matter. I have to sit in this and just see how it goes. And so, anyways, that was a massive learning experience for me.
Yeah, and as you said, it's a system, right? Like I get people reach out to me all the time, and you know, I train a number of high level professional fighters based out of Tiger Muay Thai in Phuket, Thailand. One of my guys, UFC bantamweight champion, interim champion, he flew me to Russia. I trained him over there for his last fight. And, you know, I had people reaching out to me and saying, hey, man, can I come and, you know, shadow you for a week or come and watch some of your training sessions and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, absolutely not. I'm like, you know, it's not anything against you at all, but it's like trying, if you come to one session, that's like you picking up a book at page 100 and just going, oh, here's the answer right here. And it's like, you've got no context whatsoever. Like, you know, I've gone through a 10-week periodized program to get him to this point right now, prior to, you know, going through the acute weight loss phase before we step into the cage in 2 weeks' time, you know? So I think context matters. And I think, having that system in place, the system's very important, and we'll dive into periodization in a moment, but before we go into that, I want to go back to, you know, your journey going across a number of different sports, transitioning from sport to sport, working with multiple athletes, because a question that I do get asked a lot by my followers and listeners is, you know, how do I get into the strength and conditioning space? How do I start working with professional athletes? Because, you know, a lot of trainers, when they first start out, that's their goal, is to work with professional athletes, and, you know, maybe 1 or 2% of people actually make it there. So I can tell my story about how I got there, and I have done a number of times on the podcast, but I'd like to hear your story and if you have any recommendations for people listening.
I didn't mention some of the other sports. So it was tennis. So I worked with tennis, and I worked with tennis all 8 years at Cal. Actually, that was a massive, massive learning experience too, because tennis players are so different than, I mean, so many of them, you would come across them in the gym and the strength coach will say, oh, they just don't want to work hard and make this brand of them. But then go watch them play and everything lights up. And so the question is, how do you create some of those situations in the weight room for them? Anyways, trained water polo, women's swimming as well. Eventually, I stopped track to do more of the aquatic type work. So that was my experience there. But with the professional thing, I mean, it is funny. Like everyone, like all the, even the interns that came into Cal, you say, what do you want to do? Oh, I want to do this. I want to work in college. And it's like, why do you want to work in college? Is it because in here, it's a full-time job. You get health benefits. You get paid, not extremely well, at least not in some place, some positions you can get paid well, but generally for the amount of time you're going to put into this, you're not going to. So I feel like people just say that because they don't know anything else. Like they don't, all people know here who want to get into strength and conditioning, I'm sure it's different in different parts of the world, but they're like, well, this is the full-time job. This is the carrot at the end of the stick. So that's what I want to do. Maybe other places, maybe the pro athletes, that's more the secure. Yeah, I just think safety and security drives us very hard. And I guess for a good reason, you know, but I just say, and I mean, and I've had the opportunity to work with professional swimmers, professional, and some very good track athletes as well. But like, I mean, in working with the swimming individuals that I did, I mean, people who won Olympic gold medals, world records, I learned more from them than I think they took from me. Like, I mean, these are people who are so at the top of their game in a sport that's like, I mean, they're built for the sport. And my job is not to mess them up. You know, like, I mean, some of them, we could have probably spent 20 minutes in the weight room a week, and I think they would have been okay. Like, in fact, actually, that's what I wanted. I almost, towards the end, I almost felt like they were spending too much time in the weight room for relative to what they needed. But I mean, that was great, but it's not like, I think sometimes it's like, we want to work with those people because we feel like more validated. Oh yeah, I'm a good strength coach because I work with a pro athlete. I'll tell you what, there's a lot of coaches who work with pro level athletes who probably aren't, I mean, those athletes are going to be elite no matter who works with them. Like, it's not mm-hmm. like, even the coach in some respects, like a lot of those people, the way their mind works, they are going to win. Like, it's just, yeah. they're wired to be successful. And I think it's mm-hmm. very common to, in sports performance, to take credit for the individuals who did so well. And then, but then the people don't do well. I'm not going to take credit for that. You know, it's like in the marketing perspective of it, it's just like, it's very rampant to do that. And I will say, I know individuals who are amazing physical preparation coaches who I do believe have a good strong impact on the individuals they train. But I just think it's very easy to take credit for something that, you know, you don't know how much you necessarily did. Anyways,
we're a piece of the puzzle, man. Yeah. We're a piece of the puzzle. I mean, yeah. you know, as a strength and conditioning coach, I'm working for pro fighters. I'm working alongside their striking coaches, you know, boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, wrestling, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, blah, blah, nutritionists, you know, managers. I'm one piece of the puzzle. So, you know, I totally understand exactly where you're coming from, man. And, you know, it is very difficult to quantify how much you contribute to your athletes.
Yeah.
You know, but the good athletes, they have the right team around them. They pick the right people and they put them in the right positions. And most, you know, even individual sports, man, there's a lot of team mentality, there's a lot of team components to it. Again, having the right people in the right positions to then guide that athlete.
Yeah, and I think especially on that level, from my understanding, it's as much, if not more, of who you are than the exact specs of your training battery.
Yes.
How you make that individual feel is probably the number one thing that matters in that relationship. And, you know, your training, and I say this too because I'm a type of person who takes a lot of I'm processing through this, but I get a lot of validation personally, or I think I prop myself up on being not quote-unquote knowledgeable and knowing different training modalities. And I find that you can present yourself as that to an individual, but that might not be what they need. They might just mm-hmm. need someone to ask them how their day was to emotionally identify with them. Or to draw things out of them mentally and emotionally when there's a tough place in the workout that someone else couldn't. You know, there's just different layers to this. And ultimately, it's how did you make that individual feel? And everything else is kind of a tool on that journey to how did you make them feel? How did you make them feel valued? And I think that's really important. And if you frame it that way, I think when people say, I just want to work with pros, maybe they would think about it a little differently. It's so much, I like the quote. It's like, you don't get what you want in life. You get who you are, and who you are kind of attracts you to some of those things. And so ultimately if you want to work with those athletes, I think a lot of it's a journey into yourself. And I'll say the pros I work with, they work with me because they had to, basically. Like, I was there, I was a strength coach, you have to work with me. Sorry. Like, and I mean, we had a great relationship, the pros and I, we did. But it wasn't like, I don't have like my facility and these pros are like drawn to my facility. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't that situation. So I'd say these are the things that I'm working on that I've seen in my relationship with these types of athletes that I think is really important. That is, as I try to grow myself as a coach, that I think is more and more valuable that people don't talk about enough.
Yeah, man, you made a really good point there about the coach-athlete relationship, and we'll come back to this in a moment, but you just reminded me of, you know, when I did fly to Russia and train Peter Yan for his fight camp to fight against Aljamain Sterling for the UFC bantamweight title. Aljamain pulled out of that fight. Corey Sandhagen stepped in. I went to Dubai with the guys. They all spoke Russian, man. I was in Russia with a Russian team. I was the only one that spoke English, so that was challenging to be able to communicate with them. But that was a relationship that we'd built over, you know, 3.5 years of working together since my guy signed a contract with the UFC and made his debut. So he flew me to Russia. I went over to Dubai with them. A week before the fight, his manager flew over, who I also work with at Tiger Muay Thai. Kazakh guy who speaks five languages. One of my friends called me on the phone and was like, hey, whereabouts are you sitting in the crowd? And I'm like, I don't know. So I talked to his manager and I said, hey, Sia, where am I sitting? And he goes, dude, you're in the corner. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, you're in the corner. I'm like, what the fuck am I in the corner for? Like, he's got these other guys, these training partners, his other coaches that, you know, in my mind should be in the corner because they're going to contribute more. So I'm like, why am I in the corner? And he goes, he just wants you in the corner because he, you know, he wants your presence. You know, and like I went and spoke to him and I was like, what's the deal? What do you want me to do? And my guy just goes, coach, you control situation. That's it. I don't need you to do anything. And his manager said, he just wants you in the corner because of your presence, man. You don't need to say anything. You don't need to do anything. He just wants you there. So, you know, I think that's a great point that you made about the coach athlete relationship. Did we discuss how, any advice that you can give for upcoming coaches that do want to work with not just professional athletes but athletes in general to get into the strength and conditioning world, because there's many, many different roads to Rome, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I feel like my advice can only be relatively general. And part of that's because I think it depends on what country you're in. I think there's just different structures and different job placements. What I would tell people here is I think you coach all different ages is one of the biggest things that I don't know, regardless of what you could say is how well it prepares you for a job placement. I think that people who only work with like this age group, you're in a place where you're only seeing one part of the puzzle. You know, like you said, like if someone jumps in and watches a training session and they're going in on page 100, I do think if we look at this as a giant book and it's 100 pages, if you only work with one group of eight, like 4 years of age bracket, you know, and you don't work with like youth, especially. I talk with Michael Zweifel. He runs a gym called Building Better Athletes. And he says like every coach should work with kids and pros, like at some point, like you should see those dual ends of things. You need to see where it starts and you need to see where it ends. And I've talked with Jeremy Frisch about this one of the things that has been really meaningful to me is I've started to have the opportunity to coach my daughter's five and started to get into some sports. And, you know, I'm trying not to be the overbearing dad, but I coached her soccer team last fall. And it was one of the best athletic experiences that I've gone through because it's just pure fun. It's how much fun can we have? It's pure joy. And the thing is, too, is you see these kids running around and playing. And you already can see in many cases who has the potential to be good later. And it has nothing to do at this point with strength or any of those qualities. You start to see all the little qualities that are the seeds to be good later. And you also just see it's like kind of like the eye of the tiger a little bit too, in the sense of like, well, where's the roots of where this was fun when you were a kid? You know, and you see some of the elite players, I think, in like NBA basketball, at least this is what I'm familiar with. They're warming up and they're just having fun. They're shooting crazy shots and like they're like kids, you know, and the freedom to be a child, like to think like a child, to have that mentality, at least, I think is a really key element to it. So to be able to go back and say, okay, this is where it all starts. This is this fertile soil of athleticism, and then being able to have that perspective when you see the man, the woman later on. I think that's really important. And I think it's where the greatest need is. I wish that those positions paid more, because to be honest, I feel like the world would be an interesting place if we paid youth coaches like a lot of money or a full-time job. And then the college is all volunteer. You want to work with pros at college, it's all volunteer. That would be a funny flip. But to be honest, I almost feel like the sports world would be a better place if that was the case, because I see there's a lot of it's just not like there's always need for volunteers on that level. And there's a need for education too. I mean, man, I've seen so many terrible like training programs on like the middle school, high school level. And again, it's not all about the coaching, but like it just would be nice if there was more education and just more like energy put into that end of things. And so many kids quit too. Like it's Stephen Kotler and a flow expert was on my podcast talking about quit rates, and it's like we don't develop a love for movement early. It's just like this, always this like kind of system you work through. And anyways, I just think that, sorry, that's kind of a different direction. It's almost like a little tirade that has nothing to do with professional, how will I get paid and get a job? I'm just saying work with youth, and we need more people to spend time with youth. And even if it's just, you know, a couple seasons training kids on some level. I also spent 7 years in club track working with like 9 to 14-year-olds. And that was, for track, that was really interesting too, seeing how do kids learn to move with no coaching. Like, and honestly, some of these 10-year-olds sprint better than their 18-year-old counterparts. And then the coach actually kind of messes them up. And so that was an interesting, I'm just saying from a pure skills perspective, because I do think your skills is what makes you, and to be able to command attention in a young group. Like, you got kids going every which way. There's something to that too, that I do think sometimes almost for the college sector, and it's not, this is important, but you almost have to put on this like, ah, I'm the strength coach and I'm, you know, like, listen to me. And again, you need to be,
you've got to create a presence.
Yeah, but yes, exactly. But I do think being able to also cultivate presence with kids, it's almost like a not, it's the least intimidating place to do that. And it's also one where it's like, look, if kids are starting to lose attention, it's because you're not, it's because you're not doing something that's interesting to them. And we don't credit that enough, because I think once you got kids in college and you're their paid strength coach, they have to do what you say. But it doesn't mean they're engaged. And keeping people engaged is a skill, and doing things that's meaningful is a skill. And then coaches will complain and say, oh, the athletes, they just don't want to work hard. They're not bought in. Well, do things that are meaningful for them, you know? And so anyways, I think that that youth experience can really help you to understand what is meaningful. I spent time at Rafe Kelly's Return to the Source, which is like a parkour and human movement type retreat. And that was also just really helpful in understanding and thinking about the meaning behind things. I'm not saying the whole training program has to be just fun and games. There's challenges that should exist, but it does change perspective. So I would just, my general advice is be willing to work with anybody. And the other thing too is, if you want to get somewhere, you need to be willing to intern and work for free and be very proactive with that. And like, it needs to be on the level of obsessiveness, to be honest, if that's who you truly want to work with.
100%, man. Now, I want to discuss what the system is like in the US, because I don't know too much about the system over there. And I assume that my journey into strength and conditioning has been completely different to yours. So let's talk about your journey of, you know, what you did after, you know, did you go to university, got a degree, went intern somewhere? You know, talk to me about that process. How did you end up working with these kids coaching them through track?
Yeah, so my experience getting into strength and conditioning was almost totally backwards. So I can get into that. Like, I'm like the 0.1% in how I actually got into strength coaching. Track coaching was interesting. I just think it's just so silly. I went to college for 4 years, you know, kind of didn't know what I was going to do. Then I did exercise science, and to be honest, didn't really learn anything that I actually used in coaching. And then I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go to grad school to improve my chances. And I still kind of don't know exactly what I'm going to do. So 2 years in grad school. So I've gone to college for 6 years, basically. And I'm applying for jobs and not getting any, no interviews, not hearing back. I mean, applying for everything. To be honest, some of those jobs were certainly out of my reach or range. Looking back, I was like, I had no chance at that one. But some of them, I think I might have. And it was a summer. I was actually relatively depressed, because I wasn't, here I am. I've gone to college for 6 years. This is something I'm just so passionate about. And yeah, I had back then, if anyone's familiar with my writing, like, I started writing on these like sports topics when I was really like 22, a blog for this site called Track Shark. And then I started writing my own blog on sports performance at 23. And so I'm like, you know, this is something that I have been passionate about my whole life. And I have 6 years of college, and I was coaching for 2 years, volunteer at the college. So it was a good university. So I'm like, all right, I got some experience and I should at least get an interview, and just nothing. And so, and I was working to make ends meet. I was working valet parking at a hospital, making like nothing. And I was starting to get just kind of burned out from doing the same thing over and over again at that job. So here I am, like, basically minimum wage job, can't get an interview for coaching. And then it was crazy. I basically had packed it in. I was just going to try to volunteer another year and, I guess, park cars for a living. And then I found out that the coaches who were there at the school were trying to, like, I mean, I was getting paid like, I don't know, $400 to coach. It was like a weird situation where there's a lot of split between a lot of different coaches on a low level. It's, mm-hmm. Yeah, volunteer, very low level. And they were trying to kind of give my event coaching to someone else. There was a lot of internal politics, and they were going to give my events to someone else. So here I was going to be without even a college place to coach on a volunteer basis. And so then I was like, oh man, oh shit, I better go back and look for some jobs again. And I literally, like, this job popped up that was right near a school, right near where I applied, or right where I went to college. And I was like, oh, that'd be awesome if I could get that assistant coach. It seemed my level, like, of job, applied for it. It turned out it was the very last day I could possibly have applied. And I ended up getting it, partially because the coach remembered me. I was a good high jumper. You know, and so he remembered who I was. And it's just funny because it's like, in this industry, it's not like your resume. It's just little things that stand out and people remember who you were. And mm-hmm. I remember that was one of the most joyful moments of my life, because here I go from, and honestly, I told myself too, if I can't make it in the coaching industry, maybe I'll just get my PhD in biomechanics or something. And I'm so glad that
go back to school again.
Oh, yeah, because that's what you do when you don't know what you're going to do. You just keep going in through school. And it's weird to think of what would have happened if I would have ended up doing that. I think I would have been miserable, because it's just too, that type of thing is too constricting for me. You know, you have to play by all the rules of research, and you can only, there's only so, I mean, not to diss any researchers or anything like that. It's just my brain doesn't really work like that. I have a really hard time with all those details and that consistency mm-hmm. through the research process. Some people are very wired for that. It's not my strength. I think I would have been miserable. Mm-hmm. So yeah, So that got me into the college track, and I was like kind of the strength coach for the school as well. I didn't get paid for it, but it was mm-hmm. at least a start. I was coaching athletes, and but then I started the Just Fly Sports website 3 years into that, and that actually is what led me to getting the bridge to the Division I, that bigger step up, which is
gotcha.
It's rare to step up from the low division, Division III here to Division mm-hmm. I, because it's just not that it's like Division III coaches aren't any better. It's just the same class. It's a caste system or a class system, you know, and it's like, oh, mm-hmm. you're D3, so you probably aren't very good or something, you know, whatever, like whatever opinion, thoughts. So gotcha. I got very fortunate twice. And yeah, so that was it for me. And a lot of it, but the D1 job was from writing and like doing the thing that I was gifted at and just really trying to maximize that. So I think a lot of it is finding your gifts
yeah. and making sure that just- you... Yeah, sorry, it wasn't just coaching people. It was also putting your thoughts into mm-hmm. writing and putting that into articles, getting that out onto the internet as well. So, you know, people could see that you were not just a strength coach that was, you know, putting these practices into place, but you could also put that information across to other people and teach other people how to do that. Put your thoughts into writing, put your systems into writing as well, which yeah. is a skill.
Yeah, it's skills. It's and the funny thing about this industry is like, and this was something that my first internships in strength and conditioning actually made me not want to be a strength coach, because those internships, mm-hmm. I mean, it would have been different, I think, if it was different coaches, but the individuals who I interned with, it literally is like, all right, here's this lift. Here's three things to tell athletes for this lift. You know, go around, yell at athletes, make sure they're working hard. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, this stuff is so elementary. Like, if these are the skills that make this job, like, I feel like a eighth grader could easily do this. Like, this, there's very little critical thinking. Like, where is the skill building? Like, where's the, like, if you train with, like, I don't know, like a Shaolin master or like a master acupuncturist or like someone who like has this, like, or even a massage therapist, someone who has their hands on and is getting instant feedback and like has this lifetime of mastery. Like, I would like to think that, like, if you're interning with someone, you should get that feeling from them. And I just felt like what is even happening here? And so I just feel like there's so many elements of this interdisciplinary field to grow in, to become more of a master in. And yeah, for me, it was writing and putting my thoughts down on paper and saying, this is what I think training is. Mm-hmm. And I think even within, I don't say that about strength and conditioning. Say, like, I think within the industry, there is many points of mastery. The experiences I had were did not treat the field like it was a masterful thing, if that makes sense. So I think there's a lot of ways, and I've written some articles on that as well, and how, what are some masterful things to really have your eyes on in the industry to be an act, to be someone who you can tell
what's going
to
set you apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There was something you touched, you said there that I wanted to touch on. I just lost my train of thought for a second. Let me come back. Ah, how long did you volunteer for or intern for or essentially work for free for? I think that's a big point that we need to dial in on.
Yeah. Well, so my 2 years in graduate school, my first year was a pure volunteer coach, didn't get paid anything. The second year I got like, I don't know, $500 or something, like just basically gas.
Was that for the month or? For the week?
For the whole year. I was like glorified gas.
Oh, the whole year.
But I got paid. So I guess so on my resume, I said assistant coach because I got paid. So I guess it was, that's all I care about. Hey, I'm getting money for this. I am valued. Yeah. I am an assistant coach, not a volunteer anymore. So that maybe that carried more weight. I don't know. Basically 2 years. And then I was like thinking, club track I did get paid for. Yeah. So yeah, for the most part, it was 2 years of essentially free coaching.
Yeah. I think that's a big point that a lot of people don't understand is, you know, to get into the space, man, you have to invest, you know, you don't just go to school, you get your degree and then you walk straight into a high paying job. Like you've still got to go out there and you've got to invest. You've got to find people to, you know, become your mentors and you've got to intern for them and you've got to, you know, invest time, energy and effort into, you know, training your friends, training low level athletes at club level, and then, you know, making your way up through the ranks. And you need to, you know, put that time in, man. And, you know, so many people say like, dude, you're in a really good position training professional fighters at Tiger Muay Thai in Thailand. And I'm like, well, you don't see the journey that brought me to this point, right? Like every overnight success is 10 years in the making. And I got out of the army in 2012. I was a sniper in the Australian army. Got out of the army after our last deployment to Afghanistan, did my personal training course, did my strength and conditioning course, did a number of other courses over the years. And my goal was always to work with professional athletes. And I was living down in Tasmania in Australia, small island state down the bottom of Australia. And I wasn't getting those opportunities to work with athletes. And I was putting myself in positions where I was, you know, I was training my rugby team and I was training hockey players and other athletes and things like that, you know, at a low level, at a club level. And, you know, I left a relationship with a girl that I loved and cared about to move to Thailand to put myself in a position to work with, you know, to intern at this gym, work there for free so that I could put myself in a position to take any opportunities that came up. So, you know, I did that. I got lucky. I was there at the right place at the right time. I ended up, you know, ex-military, very professional, punctual, you know, was always where I was supposed to be doing what I was supposed to be doing. Just doing my job, basically providing value, and got offered a full-time job. And then I became the head strength and conditioning coach like 6 months later after the old coach left. And, you know, I knew what I was doing in terms of strength and conditioning, but I hadn't been able to apply that with professional athletes and with mixed martial arts fighters. So I had to, you know, go up to these fighters and be like, hey man, do you have a strength and conditioning coach? Can I train you for free? Let's go through this program. And it was years and years and years of doing that, man, before, you know, I got to this position where I'm at now. And that's a big point that I think a lot of people don't understand is like, you need to be willing to work for free. You need to be willing to put yourself in these positions that is going to show your worth, is going to show your value before anyone even takes you seriously. Because, you know, you need to build those systems out. You need to have proof of concept that these athletes that you have worked with for years, you know, you have been able to get them results. You have been able to contribute to their success. You have been able to contribute to their journey as well, along with the other coaches.
Yeah. Yeah. That obsessiveness towards like, I will get this job and I'll do whatever it takes. I will say too, though, I think there is an important element of like being willing to pivot in the sense of like here, like if I was doing it all over again here in the United States, I don't know that for me in my position, like it's easy to say, but I don't know if I would directly try to be like a college strength coach here just because I don't know, like just, I think there's, there, is I would just say also have a dose of like a willing opportunity to look at other things that maybe you didn't. You know, I think it's definitely awesome to say, I want to do this, work with these athletes. I think some people, and I say that, I guess, from the perspective of, I felt like a lot of interns that came across at Cal were a little disillusioned. And I only say that in the sense that it's like they just expected to go get this job. And a lot of them mm-hmm. needed to spend a lot more time doing really good where they were at before they got that job. And I think that fits with what I'm not trying to like divert from what you were saying, but it's like you need to be really good with where you're at. Like if you're a volunteer, you need to be the best damn volunteer. If you're going to be mm-hmm. a personal trainer, like, and you want to eventually work in college or whatever, but like you should be killing it at what you're doing right now. And that's the thing, is I saw a lot of people who were not. Like, it's just they had the perspective of, I'm here, I'm going to be a volunteer assistant here at this university, I'm going to have this on my resume, it's going to get me to the next level. And I just don't think it works like that. Like, wherever you are, whoever you're working with, I believe that you cannot reach the next level until there's a certain level of gratitude for what you're doing right now and competence on that level. Like, and I think even for me, like at Wisconsin Lacrosse grad school, like I was really grateful just to be basically volunteering or getting paid $500 a year to be working with yep. those athletes. And I was really shaken up when I was going to get that opportunity to work for free taken away from me, because I really valued it. I put a lot of time mm-hmm. and effort into that, and I wanted to do the best I could. And the interns who did make it out of Cal were the ones who had that mentality. They had a huge ownership of what they were doing. There was like whatever I'm doing now, I'm going to be the best I can at it, no matter what it is. And mm-hmm. I think that even if it was coaching like youth sports, like be the best at that, be the best 5-year-old soccer coach. Like I remember my 3-year-old son did this like soccer thing, and thank God it's not actually soccer. It's just like physical education with some soccer balls thrown in. They do a good job here in the city. But I saw this across the field, there's this coach who is like just killing it. Like he probably has like a background in improvisational acting. Like he's just making this training come alive for these 3-year-olds. They're having a blast. Like they're having so much fun. And it's like that's someone who, he's not getting paid. None of us are getting paid for this. And he's just like mm-hmm. fully investing himself with the group in front of him, where he's at, making this come alive for these kids. Like no matter what you do, you should have that mentality. Be the best at where you're at. Be totally grateful for where you're at, because I don't think that you can really level up until you fully appreciate what you're doing right now. And it might actually change where you think you should go to. And I think that's something to be open to, because that's what's happened with me. Used to think, and I only say that because I used to think I wanted to be a Division I track coach. Like that was my goal. Like be the best track jumps coach. Like that was always my goal. And now I'm sitting back here at age 38 and I'm like, you know, that wasn't your thing. That wasn't what you were meant to do. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with not being like, you know, the best college jumps coach or something. That's fine. But I mean, goals are important, but I think, you know, gratitude and being good, like mastering where you are now, is really important too.
Yeah. And, you know, I love what you said about showing perseverance as well. You know, sometimes it is going to take time to invest in the position that you're currently at to, you know, get really good at it before you then are able to take that step to the next level. And, you know, that's where a lot of people go wrong, I believe, is they believe that they deserve more than where they're currently at. So they get disillusioned, they get disheartened, you know, they've been grinding for a year and they're not where they want to be. So they just give it up and they throw the towel in, you know, where sometimes you need to graft for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years before you can, and be really good at what you're doing over that time before you can take that next step. From here, mate, I want to transition to, let's talk about the force velocity curve and then why you wrote your book Speed Strength, and I'm sure that's going to tie in together. So what is speed strength? Where does that sit on the force velocity curve, and why did you write that book?
Yeah, so speed strength was when I like to like almost write books when chapters close sometimes. When I was coaching, doing strength and conditioning for track, I had just finished writing a book called Vertical Ignition, which was like when I started Just Fly Sports, I was like, I'm going to write a vertical jump book and make $1 million. Like, I remember I was at Barnes & Noble, like, going through, like, business books when I was 27 or 28, and, like, I was all excited. I was like, yes, I'm gonna do this. And I came across a book called, like, Get Rich Click or something. This is, like, 50, everything's totally different now. But the first page was a guy who, his name's Jacob Hiller. He made, like, millions of dollars selling some vertical jump book. And a lot of it was through this thing called ClickBank, which is a massive affiliate marketing. But anyways, I read this and I was like, oh, like, I'm such a good coach. And, you know, I got a guy doing the website who's amazing. Like, we're going to kill it. We're going to, and, you know, so I finally wrote that book and it did not make $1 million. But when after I wrote that book, I had finished with being a strength coach for track. I was fully into aquatics now and then tennis still doing, but I was like, I should close that chapter by writing something where I felt like, here's all the things I felt like really were really helpful for strength training for sprinting. And then it was funny because I was like, all right, well, I need to write at least a chapter on sprint mechanics, like, cause you need to have sprint mechanics. But it was really funny because here I am having spent 6 years as a track coach and still coaching club track and then also doing strength training for track. And I'm sitting down to write this mechanics chapter. And I'm like, I really don't know what to write. Like, I kind of was like, I bought all the books. I bought, like, Franz Bosch Running and James Smith's, the Thinker Smith's book on sprinting, and, like, watched all these, you know, like, watched some of these higher level coaches on their sprint presentations. And I had this chapter kind of written out as a conglomeration of those thoughts. And then I met Darian Barr, who's been on my podcast, who's like a just as nuanced of an individual as you can get with how the human body works and timing. Like, this is a guy who watches a bird take off for 3 hours to figure out why
listened to that podcast you did with him, and I was like, my mind was blown, man. I was like, oh, I had to go back and, like, had to pause and think on things for, like, a couple of minutes and then go back and play it again. And I was just like, holy shit, that's very nuanced.
I didn't understand Adarian very much. I would listen to him for an hour on the phone and I would understand like 5 minutes of it. And slowly as I got along with him, I started to understand more and more and more. And there was a long jumper he was working with the very first day I came out and watched him coach, and I didn't understand like anything. But the long jumper like knew everything he was saying. And I was like, man, this is, but that's what I'm talking about, the skill too. Like that was me growing, is understanding what the heck Adarian is saying and being able to tie it to movement. So, long story short, I feel like one of the things that ended up, that book ended up being a lot more than just a book on strength training for sprinting, because Adarian, in my time with him, I completely rewrote that first chapter. And a lot of it too was like, I was starting to do the things Adarian has shown me, and I was setting personal bests at age like 33, 34 in sprinting that I didn't think was possible, because I was doing all the old drills and like, oh, this would, you know, with like as if they were going to work. And then, well, it turns out they didn't, and I needed to do something else. So a lot of it was just was learning from him. And it's just, I don't know, it's just been like a thing in my life where it's like, where you set out to do something, like, and you put yourself out there, like, whatever your belief system is, the universe conspiring in your favor. I do believe that there is a element of that when you really put out. And so for me, going out to put out to do this book, and I'm like, I want this to be the best, you know, the best I can put out there with how do all things fit together to build speed. And so, yeah, it was a lot of Adarian's influence in biomechanics, and then a lot of it just, yeah, going through the power lifts, the Olympic lifts, special strength, plyometrics, how does all this actually fit into running faster? And so that was, that was that book. And that took 3 years to write. And it was a lot of revising. A lot of times, like I'd be in the shower and like something would hit me that Adarian said. I was like, like, I got to go right away, go write this down. I had this huge thing of notes and like this massive sheet of notes. And so, yeah, that book was quite the project. But yeah, with the force velocity curve, like, yeah, it was kind of a play on words. Like, speed strength is part of the, you know, you have speed strength. To be completely honest, Sean, I don't even know those brackets. I don't know them from an academic perspective. And the funny thing is I do believe Christian Thibodeau was on my show, a brilliant Canadian strength coach. And he said something I think is really, you know, it's like, yes, there's nuance and there's art. There should be a skill as you get better at this. But at the end of the day, you should also be able to really simplify out training and to the perspective of, I don't think all those layers of the force velocity curve are truly necessary at the beginning. And when they come in, it should be kind of like it because they're needed. I think it's very easy for a coach to say, all right, well, I'm the strength coach. And so, you know, you're going to do some basic, you know, hypertrophy work, and you're going to do some high velocity work here, and you're going to do some rapid plyometrics here, and we're going to cover the spectrum because, but I don't know, go watch someone do their sport and they're going to basically cover the spectrum too. And many, I mean, it's going to be more velocity oriented, but you're going to have some slower movements. You're going to have some faster ones. Like they're going to, the human body, I always feel like the human body is designed to do its job. Like, it, how much outside influence from what we've made up as training does the human body need? I mean, yeah, it could be, it could help it for sure. But in the perfect world, I think that just doing some basic, like look at like Michael Jordan would be a good example in basketball. Like the guy worked out on machines and then played his sport and was amazing. How much more mm-hmm. would doing like jump squats or something have helped him? Probably zero, in my opinion. I think he, you know, he could just take basic strength and then his sport and connect it all in, you know, a very athletic way. And so I think the starting point really is just that. It's doing your sport insanely well. So having a great movement competency, having the mental and emotional abilities, you know, skill, exposure to different sports, all that stuff. And then basic strength, on the other hand, doesn't have to be anything fancy. Can the athlete do well with that? And then if there's gaps, okay, maybe there's a gap right here. Okay, let's do a little bit of extra work at this, like in the middle layer, if that makes sense. Like let's do some extra work with this component of the force velocity curve that maybe that will help you to bridge this gap a little bit better. I think you could say that for like special strength too. Like maybe like an isometric standing plantar flexion or an isometric maximal hip bridge. Maybe that'll bridge a gap for a particular athlete that can't cross that on their own. So that's kind of where I look at it is you should be able to get a lot just doing the basics, the pulls, but then you can bring the stuff in selectively. I will say too, is I think that doing a lot of them in the middle stuff over a long period of time can divert resources. So like if I look at, I have a limited amount of adaptation. I need to maximally adapt to my sport. So how do I maximally adapt and create the least amount of noise in the process? So that being said, I still do. I love Olympic lifts. I use things like Olympic lifts, which is in the middle. But I like Olympic lifts because they're fun. It's more fun than doing jump squats. It's more fun in many cases than just squatting or doing a hex bar deadlift. So there's if it's enjoyable, I think that to me almost is more important than for me like kind of looking at what does this tick on this spectrum. Of velocity would be a way that I would look at that. So that's my take, I guess, on the force velocity curve. I think it can be helpful, but I don't think it's necessarily the first place that we should go.
That's something that I'm going to look at through a periodized plan with my athletes. Like if I've got a big athlete who is really strong, has really good starting strength, but doesn't have very good elastic strength, then I'm probably going to work a little bit more speed and more speed strength and go into more jumps and sprints and throws, change of direction and things like that. If I've got, you know, a small athlete who is quite elastic, but doesn't have good starting strength, then I might work a little bit higher on that force velocity curve, more towards the strength end. And that's kind of how I use it. And, you know, for the listeners, very simple way of thinking about the force velocity curve. One end is strength. Force is our strength, our ability to produce force. So that might be a one rep max deadlift, for example. And then strength speed is going to be something that's heavy, requires a lot of strength, but also an element of speed. So that might be an Olympic lift, which is close to, you know, your three rep max or something like that. And then power is going to be right in the middle of a perfect combination of strength and speed. Which is, you know, our jumps, throws, maybe the Olympic lift again at a sub-maximal weight, 40, 50, 60%, where it's more about bar velocity, bar speed. And then we've got our speed strength. So this might be like a hill sprint where the focus is on speed, but there is also an element of strength. And then down the bottom end is our velocity, which is our speed, which might be a straight up sprint. So that's how I kind of look at it. That's how I explain it. And if I look at my athletes, I'm looking at, you know, what their sport is. I'm looking at what they're good at. I'm looking at any gaps that they may have that I could potentially fill with a periodized training program.
Yeah, yeah, the filling the gaps. And yeah, not to take away from... I say that I have tended to make things much more complex than they've needed to be in my past. And so I'm always looking at how can I give the athlete the optimal chance to do this on their own before we need to come in and fill in the gaps. And I totally agree. Like athletes, Graham Morris was on this show who has worked with some fighters and talked about like even oscillatory isometrics as a gap filler, like where you're just switching on and off really quickly, like firing a muscle on and off as fast as possible in a short range of motion. And he had mentioned how helpful that was in helping kick velocity, for example. So someone who has trouble storing and releasing tension will need that to fill the gap for them. And I do by nature in an average training program, like an athlete who wants to work with me online and they want to jump, be more generally more powerful, and they're playing sports maybe once a week, I will usually have... Yeah, different, like it won't just be bodybuilding and sprinting. Like there is multiple layers in there. There's usually Olympic lifts. There's usually different elements to master for sure. So I'll just say that I don't, I think that like how that's changed for me. And I'm a big, I love like French contrast, complex training with layers in it, like where you're doing a heavy lift, a heavy jump, like then a quick lift and then a fast jump. Like, that stuff gets results so fast. I mean, it's if you want to get powerful, that will get you powerful real fast. So I'm not.
Just for the audience, man, because I love contrast training. I use it all the time. But for the audience, can you give them an example of some exercises that you would link together in that order?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, French contrast has been not an obsession, but like I've written like big articles on it for other websites and have been really into all the combinations. Cause again, if Michael Jordan probably didn't need that because he was a beast. He could make that transfer over or Zion Williamson or any Usain Bolt, anyone who's elite from that speed power perspective, they can make the jump. But for the rest of us or people who are not quite as that level, yes, you can bridge the gap very fast with contrast training. So yeah, I could tell you some favorites I actually used in swimming. And I used it in swimming. Short course swimming, you wanted to be powerful off the walls and things, but it was also fun. I think it helped raise dopamine levels. They just enjoyed it. And so that's another, I think that might be something too. That's maybe why I don't classify things so tightly is I just like, all right, here's power work and it's fun. Okay. And you're jumping higher each week, so I think we're on the right track. And so, like a common movement, I kind of classified it into two patterns. There'd be like a pull pattern contrast, or a squat pattern, or push pattern contrast. So for a pull pattern, maybe we would start with like a hex bar deadlift off of blocks or straps. So it's like maybe a half range hex bar deadlift pull. And obviously, these athletes are going to be able to pull a lot of weight. You know, maybe 200 kilos. It's they can handle a lot of weight. And then the next thing is we would do a heavy jump. So for swimmers, for another athlete, it might be a low depth jump. For a swimmer, maybe it's you're wearing a weighted vest and you're doing a seated box jump or something. So something that's more concentric, but something that's just a slower jump. Or maybe I'll say, hey, go, I like doing skill stuff. So you could be go jump and try to touch as high as you can on the vertec or something like that. Anyway, just like a heavier jump. So you got your heavy lift, heavy jump. Then the light lift would be like a light pull would be like a power clean or a hang clean. So go and do a power clean. Maybe there's a velocity, bar velocity tag on it to help motivate them to move it faster. And then there would be a speed jump. So maybe it's just like 10 seconds of fast line hops. Maybe it's three standing broad jumps that for speed or something like that. So that would be the tail end of it. So just variations. A squat pattern might be you're going to do a front squat or something like that. Then you're going to do a weighted jump of some sort. Then maybe it's like a speed push press or some speed squats or some goblet jump squats. And then you again have the fast plyo, so some rapid line hops or something like that. You have like those types of patterns. And it's like this wave, this descending wave of power. And we would usually go through that when I first started, we would do 3 or 4 rounds of that. But as I went on, and this is again where I'm looking at the dosage of this stuff, like these athletes are swimmers and they are doing a ton of work in the water. And the more I would realize it, like, I don't, even if this stuff can make you powerful, I don't want to take away your bucket, your water adaptation. Like, even if this is great, mm-hmm. like we're getting more powerful, I still might not want to even trade power for your specific adaptation in the water. Like, general power in the weight room is great, but it will only help you so far. Like, an Olympic level swimmer needs to have almost all their adaptation go to their specific expression of that in the water. And so I eventually got to the point where instead of 3 or 4 rounds, we would just do 2. And Bobby Stroop, who I've had on my podcast, trains Patrick Mahomes, he'll just do 1 sometimes. And I think that's okay. So we would just do, we would do 2 in the fall, in the off season, and then I would let them do 3 when they were going to peak. So it's almost like, just to treat as this potentiation. And that seemed to be the best split rather than like, oh, we're going to build the base, which you want a base of your sport, you know, I don't know, on some level. I mean, yeah, you want some other movements in there, but for the most part, your base, if you're a swimmer, is more swimming and then you'll taper. Like, so why, I don't think your base should be a bunch of stuff that's not your sport. We just want to use this to give you more power here and there, you know, or more dopamine release, or, you know, more neural excitation. So I would treat the progression that way, actually work better in my opinion. So that would be a way that I tended to use it for that population. And then the pro swimmers, I think I started almost, they would be the ones who would actually probably do better with just 1 set of it, because they're, you know, they have the strength. They don't need any more strength. Like, they're strong enough for what they need to do and powerful enough. So maybe just 1 set.
Yep. Let's talk about periodization. How important is periodization for athletes?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it just depends on what your definition is. And I've changed mine over time. I mean, you have the traditional Tudor Bompa, you know, grade, like that's the old school, like we're going to come in with a bunch of general work for a block, then we're going to go to hypertrophy or muscle size, then we're going to go to strength, then we're going to go to power. Like, I don't think it tends to unfold like that. It's very rare. I on the other end, you have Bondarchuk, the track coach's schemes, which is basically no periodization, which is literally just, here's a block of training with different layers of transfer exercises. And as soon as you stop getting gains from this, we're just going to switch everything. All the exercises will change. And the goal of the
That's still a plan, though.
Yeah. It's just,
that's the point that I'm making, is it's like periodization is a plan. And like most people, a lot of people, you know, I've got athletes that listen to this, I've got coaches that listen to this, I've got regular people that listen to this. So, you know, I've spoken about periodization before and how important periodization is, and is essentially just having a plan, man. You know, if you're just going to the gym and you're just working out, like, that workout's really not going to give you too much. It's not going to add to your sport. It's, you know, it's going to give you your workout. It's going to give you, you know, that adaptation right there and then, but it's not adding to the overall plan. And I mean, that's what periodization is. It's like, let's look at the plan. Where do I want to be? How am I going to move myself in the right direction, so I'm peaking at the right time for an event, for a tournament or whatever it might be? And that's the difference between training and working out, right? And that's essentially what periodization is. It's a plan to, I want to be here. How do I take those steps that's going to get me peaking at the right time?
Yeah. I think that, yeah, I would, so I mentioned terminology. I would just call periodization, yeah, just having a plan, just knowing the frame, the bones. Behind me, I have the bones of what will be some nice paneling for this room, the bones of what I'm doing. But I think people who have, you know, like, will say, like, oh, periodization is dead. Like, it's just terminology. Like, there's coaches that say, oh, periodization is dead. You just need to be adjust and adapt on the fly. And I think, to be honest, that's true, but it also can be, it's a plan on knowing how you're going to adapt. What markers am I looking for? How will I change things if those change? You could still say it's periodization. It's just having a plan and knowing where to go. I think the problem exists in periodization when actually the plan supersedes what is happening right now here in this training session, like just pure human, human grade training. And so I just think if people have, I think when we say you need to have a plan or we talk about periodization, we look at the average gym goer who literally has no, like maybe they'll go do some bench, they'll go do some curls, they'll go do a few squats. Like, they just look like they're lost. And I think that, you know, I worked with swim coaches who, in swimming as opposed to track, there's very little classical periodization in swimming, in the sense of a swim coach who will say, we're in this phase, we have this many weeks of loading, this many of unloading. I've never seen a swim coach. One time I saw a swim coach say that. Versus track, you see it all the time. Track is very, very more formalized in that perspective. But the question is which one will get better results? And I look at swim coaches, I feel like they kind of went through like kind of plans, and then it just all becomes intuitive. And I think that's kind of how, I think sometimes maybe you take for granted, like for where I'm at, like I've gone through all the periodization schemes, and I think sometimes it's easy for me just to say, oh, it's just all about the session, because I've intuitively, I know where I'm going. So it's like, I'm not going to not, but I think, you know, looking at that coach who just will do anything, you know, every couple weeks they'll change it just because, like, I think it's more like principles of, if you're going to change exercises, why? If you're going to change volumes, why? Just have an answer. Like, that's, to me, that's the most important thing. Just have an answer. Not even, because I've seen coaches just write up yearly training plans that look amazing. It's like, oh, this month is this, and this month is this. And I'm like, that's, I don't know, it's kind of,
that's too far.
It's too far. Like, it's not going to look like that's that. Too far. And it's like, it's almost by writing that, you assume that plan is going to take you there, when in the reality, it's how are things going on the day, in the session? Are you creating systems of belief, of motivation? Are you getting the most out of that athlete on the given day? That's the core. Like, that is the core essential. And then you work outward from there. I think it's almost like we try to make escapes for that. And some, like, people who can't really get into that are the ones who are going to go crazy with the periodization schemes. And like this is like, this over analytical approach. So I just think you have to be able to answer questions as to what you're doing. That's the big one. When asked, why did I do this? Why did I change this?
You need to be able to justify it.
Yeah, you should have an answer. Like, you should just have an answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, mate, you make a great point there about, you know, periodization. You know, some people do go so far down into the weeds, and like, they have literally, like, you know, their macro cycles, mesocycles, micro cycles, blah, 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 blah. Like, they've got all these cycles planned out, and then like, they don't know how to auto-regulate the session, you know, but then that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is the person that doesn't have any fucking idea of what they're doing in their training session. They're just making shit up on the fly, right? Like, that's not a good place to be either. So, you know, the point that you made about, yes, you need to kind of have a plan, and you need to be able to, if someone asks you why you're doing something or why you've changed something, you need to be able to know why you did that. So, you know, a plan is like, where do I want to be? What do I want to give my athlete in this training session? All right, what's the intent of this training session? All right, the intent of this training session is we're going to work on strength and stability, and then we're going to finish with a little bit of aerobic conditioning. All right, cool. That's going to then determine what exercises I'm going to choose, the order that I'm going to put them in, the sets, the reps, the weights, the rest periods, the intensities, the volume, blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, understanding that stuff, what the intent is very important. And that's on a day-to-day basis. That's also on a week-to-week basis, a month-to-month basis, because, you know, if I do too much with my professional fighter in my strength and conditioning session in the morning, and he then goes into the sparring class in the afternoon, and he can't hold his hands up, and he's getting punched in the face by other high-profile fighters, you know, that are absolute killers, then I haven't done my job. I've done too much. I've now taken away from his training and his adaptation rather than adding to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, just knowing, and that's part of the plan too. If you're a strength coach, you can't live on the island of, well, here's my plan, and then you're not even looking at, and this is the sad thing, though, is in a lot of sports here in the United States, like, if I was to ask a sport coach at a university, hey, what's your weekly plan? What's your monthly plan? What does this generally look like? Or can you tell me throughout the week, like, what are your high days? What are your low days? They can't tell you. Everything is just kind of medium. There's literally nothing. And so then you're like, well, I guess I'll just do my own plan. Or you're just kind of constantly reacting. It's like, all right, the athletes came in feeling terrible this day. I have to react. And then the plan that I think I made just goes to, you know, it goes to shit. Like, so the unfortunate reality in many cases is, and this is the thing, is like, this is where sport needs to fundamentally change is, I mean, I think the sport coaches will kind of like, they get a little shaky. It's like, oh, I have to plan my week out. Like, I can't, like, but it's like, look, you don't have to like hyper manage everything. Just have a general idea of what are the days that are going to be more intense, low intense, why are they that way? It's going to help you. Yep. Like, it doesn't mean you have to like completely change everything you're doing. You just have to like have a, and this is why I feel like I, you know, I'm writing this book on strength and conditioning for swimming right now. You know, I've kind of closed the chapter on some degree. I do still work with swimming online right now, but I want to make it clear in the book, like if you coach swimming, you should know how to coach strength and conditioning. You should know how to do strength training because this is just human adaptation. And how did so many like sport coaches get to, a lot of sport coaches got to the place they did, at least here, because they're very good recruiters. They play the game. They recruit the right talent. They know how to lead a team. That's awesome. Those are things, some things that I'm not that great at, but they got there without ever really, at least a lot of them didn't really study how humans adapt. And so then it's like, how does the strength coach work with that? I just feel like we all need to have these basic principles that we can work together off of. And I've had that conversation with a few coaches on my own podcast. So I think that relationship with of the sport coach to the physical preparation coach is a really important one.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And I'm in a very good position where I'm at the gym that I'm working at. Like, I've got a good relationship with the skills coaches, so you know, I'm in constant conversation with them, going, you know, and I'll sit down with my athletes and say, all right, we're gonna push you to boxing, we're gonna do PT boxing sessions 3 times a week, then you're gonna go to kickboxing class here, you can do strength and conditioning 3 times a week, you can do mixed martial arts here, you can do Brazilian jiu-jitsu here, and like, we're literally planning out the week, and we're like, all right, let's follow this for a couple of weeks. The intent or the purpose of this training block is going to be, you know, get your strength and conditioning up. Let's start managing your weight. Let's start dropping a little bit of body fat. You know, build those skills because, you know, as a fighter, you already know how to fight. So we don't need to invest more time and energy into that. You've been doing that all year round anyway. Let's take a couple of weeks where we really focus on the strength and conditioning, you know, teach you how to organize your body in a manner that's going to allow you to produce the most amount of force possible with the least amount of movement, allow that to transfer through the chain, carry that through to your skill-based sessions. Now you've got a more explosive athlete with better endurance that's able to, you know, organize themselves in a better manner to be able to adapt to those skills that their skills coach want. Let's do that for a couple of weeks and then we transfer. So I'm talking to the coaches saying, hey, I'm going to push him hard this day, this day. This is going to be a high day. You need to do a low day in the afternoon. I'm going to do a moderate day in the morning. You need to do moderate or high in the afternoon. Okay. And then maybe I do a lower intensity day. You do a higher intensity day in the afternoon. If I know he's got MMA sparring on Friday afternoon and I've got him in the morning, I'm not pushing him hard. I'm giving him enough. I'm giving him enough of the adaptation or enough of the stimulus we need for the desired adaptation, but not so much. I'm now taking away from that training session in the afternoon. And I think that communication between the coaches has to be there, man. And they have to have that base level understanding of, you know, stimulus, recovery, adaptation.
Yeah, for sure. That's really cool that you're able to communicate on that level. I think that would be an ideal. You know, I just think that, and I'm not too familiar with fighting, but I think that it sounds like that's a really positive situation. I know it's a little bit of a struggle for a lot of coaches with his sport here, so in those types of training loads, so it's great you're able to do that.
Yeah, thanks, man. I think it's interesting, like speaking to different coaches in different parts of the world, and you know, the systems that they have in place and the channels that they go through to get to where they're at. And you know, I definitely seem to be in a unique situation. You can probably say the same thing for yourself as well, you know, talking to many coaches from around the world for your podcast.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear. I mean, it's different perspectives on sport. The more you know, and that's one of the beauties, I think, the thing of being a strength coach is you get to, like, although you're maybe not super specific to what you're working with, you can really collect some of the nuances of all these different forms of activity. And it's a really cool dynamic.
Yeah. Mate, let's start wrapping up the episode. Is there any resources that you can recommend for people listening back home, podcasts, audio books, you know, texts or courses or anything like that, that have really shaped your career, that have stuck in your mind that you use as kind of one of your favorite references?
Yeah. Someone else asked me the book question on a recent podcast. It's funny because I actually had no idea what to answer. Because I don't read as many strength and conditioning books as I used to. And I think part of it is because, I mean, running the podcast, I'm have a lot of information too. And so it's like just doing that and taking the notes is kind of like a book in every week. And so I think too with books, it's very easy to read, especially in this like hyper competitive industry, people will brag how many books they read. And you know, it's so easy to do that and not actually intake information. I've heard it said you when you learned it and you used it, then you could kind of say you've read it. And I think the books that embody that the most for me, it would be Easy Strength is a book that I've gone back to a few times with rereading with Dan, John, and Pavel. That one is like a standard. It could replace college courses. It's just, it's brilliant. It's like this, it's block one in so many ways. So that was a really good one. There's a book called The Greatest Sports Training Book Ever, which I don't even know who wrote it. It's very esoteric. It's and you can't get it. You can't buy it anymore. If you want it, you can email me because I have a copy that I don't mind sending electronically because it is no longer for sale and the author is anonymous. So that book, I don't know, people surmise that Jay Schrader or someone in that camp wrote it, but that book is brilliant on another level. Like it's advanced reading, but it, if you've been coaching and just seeing how people adapt, I think for a while it makes all the sense in the world. And I don't coach athletes to a T like the programs say, but it also just kind of using it as a guideline. I think like Easy Strength is the basic, the bread and butter that you need to be familiar with. And there is some advanced stuff in Easy Strength, but then if you want to get more advanced and look at things on more, I guess, the neurological level, that book is awesome. It probably doesn't help me to mention it because you can't buy it. You can like email me to get it. I might have a shared file with like 150 people with that book. So it's so there's that one. And I will say, like, if I was going to give a book that's more like, I don't know, like I feel like it's also on the other end because we just so often we just want to read like just like not database, but like here's give me some like sets and reps and principles of training. But then on the other end of the spectrum, like what I would say, like the wild human, like training the human being, there's a book called The Exuberant Animal that I just picked up this last year. I spent last July at Rafe Kelly's Return of the Source Retreat, and I was reading this book. It's by a guy named Frank Frencich, who just, it's basically like, how are we wired to innately move? Like, how do animals move? How do we move in nature? And then you think, well, how does training differ from how we move in nature, like how we're, or sport for that matter? And so, for example, like one of the things would be in nature, you never know how long you're going to run. Like an animal being chased, you don't know how long you're going to have to run for, or you don't know how long you're going to have to chase. Or it's like playing tag. When you're playing tag, do you know how long you're going to have to run? Or even sport, you don't know. And but there's a beauty to that. But then everything in strength and conditioning or track or whatever is yeah, and so it's like this book is amazing because it just brings us into what it means to be a human being, and it also has a massive dose of what I feel is purpose, in the sense that how many athletes after they're done, I saw this rampantly in swimming, like swimmers would be done with college and they were done swimming forever because they're, it just was such a grind. It was almost like a little bit of PTSD because like morning practices, looking at this black line, lots of difficult like practices, and I think that's fine. Difficulty is important. It's a critical ingredient, but purpose is also a critical ingredient, and having fun and feeling like a human being or like that childlike element. And so that The Exuberant Animal was a book that I think that every aspiring strength coach should read, should be familiar with. You should be able to lead a session in that manner, which is more play-based, just as you should be able to lead a session in a very drill-based, you know, very the typical manner. You should be familiar with both of them. And so those would be three that I think would provide a lot of a wide-ranging perspective on what we do.
Love that. And also your podcast, Just Fly Performance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can listen to that one too.
I'll have that linked in the show, mates. Mate, to round out the episode, the name of this podcast is Live, Train, Perform, which stands for Live Life to the Fullest, Train to Your Potential, and Perform at Your Best. What does that mantra mean to you?
Yeah, so I checked that question out, and it was cool because it's like, all right, I've got to think about this for a minute, because if you just asked it to me and I hadn't thought about it, I probably would have no idea. But it, to me, living life to the fullest potential is like, especially with like training, it's purpose, and it's, I just find it interesting how many like strength coaches will, I don't know, it's almost like, I find, this is my theory, but I feel like a lot of strength coaches and personal trainers have a lot of repressed anger. And so, not that's not a bad thing. I have repressed anger, by the way. But like,
you feel attacked, bro.
You, no, like it's you turn on like the you know aggressive music and you take your oppressed anger out on the weights, and that's like the purposeful thing that you do in your day. It's a release. But like, there's a lot more purpose outside of that, in the sense of like even just like doing something like parkour in the woods, playing games with other people, like doing rock climbing. I don't know, like finding something that's a bit outside of that release mechanism that I, again, I think is cool. I mean, I've done that my whole life, is finding like purpose that goes beyond that, something that you fundamentally enjoy doing. And so for what nuance of strength and conditioning is fundamentally meaningful to you? That is beyond, I would say, challenge someone to say beyond just lifting iron, beyond just that, because strength is awesome, but I just think there's a lot more to movement and the movement equation than just that. And so finding, I guess, living life to the fullest is fully embracing that purpose. And maybe it is lifting, maybe that is, but then how do you fully embrace that? How do you fully embody whatever it is that you're doing? And I think that when we grow to our full potential, then the athletes can reap the benefits of that. I think so much, it's not what we necessarily come up with to write or give, you know, for the athletes program. It's who we are that they pick up on. And so like kind of maximizing that journey, that potential in yourself, I think is really, really helpful. The second one, perform at your best or train to your potential. I think that training at your potential, I think it's just with that, like you only will hit the potential of the purpose that you have to get there. If you don't have much purpose, you're just not going to make it. And so I think part of it is finding the things that are truly purposeful and meaningful for you. What's purposeful for you, maximally purposeful, might not be that thing for me. So being able to find that will help you to realize that. And so I think some of it too is even thinking like, I think the dreams and visions for myself that I would have had 2 years ago have changed, partly because of learning who I am a little bit more. So, kind of going into that self-awareness and that purpose and finding that meaning, and then that meaning can carry you. I don't think we should have to force things so much sometimes. I think if we're on the right track, it's more about like letting the brakes off than it is like consciously just like shoving yourself forward every day. That's at least my take on it. So that's where I've gone is finding things in a training perspective that I find more innately meaningful has been really helpful for me. A lot of that's been doing more work in nature. So on a personal level, it's been really helpful.
Love that, man. Love that. I love hearing the answers from all the different people that I get on you know, what their take is on that mantra, because, you know, those answers are so diverse and so different. Joel, it's been an absolute pleasure having a conversation to you, mate. It's an honor to have you on my podcast. I do enjoy listening to your podcast. I'll have all of your links in the show notes. Hopefully, I can get on your podcast one day.
Yeah, man. It's been great talking. So, I'm sure this will definitely not be our only conversation. It was really wonderful talking to you.
I appreciate it, Joel. Thanks, mate. Take care.
Yeah, you as well.
This episode was brought to you by Swiss8, which is a proactive mental health program designed by veterans, initially for veterans, that has been pushed out to the wider community, that allows you to structure in and schedule their 8 pillars of health and wellness, including nutrition, sleep, time management, discipline, fitness, personal growth, mindfulness, and minimalism. This episode was also brought to you by Be Spunky, which is a male hormone optimization supplement that I've been taking for about a year and a half, and I absolutely rate. It is a TGA listed nutraceutical, meaning that it's made from all organic produce to help you manage and optimize your stress levels, which in turn increases your ability to improve testosterone production levels naturally. Use the code COBS10 at checkout for your 10% discount. All of those links will be in the show notes. If you got some benefit from this episode, please make sure you pass it off to your friends and family. I'd appreciate any shares on social media platforms. If you tag me or if you share it to your stories, make sure you tag me so I can share that as well. Any 5-star ratings and reviews are much appreciated. Much love, guys. Peace.